This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love him. Love.
Because you'll never love anyone but yourself.
For the love, love.
And I love you more than anything.
There's to love. Love.
From the New York Times, I'm Dan Jones.
And I'm Mia Lee. This is the Modern Love Podcast.
Today's essay is about fate, and it's about horoscopes.
I check my horoscope actually every morning in bed after checking the weather.
Wow, I had no idea.
And while I don't put too much weight in it, I keep coming back every single day.
The essay is called The Heart Said Yes and the Horoscope Said No.
It's written by Amisha Patel and read by Sunila Nankani.
Ever since I was a child, I have known my destiny. Not in the subtle ways that some believers in fate know, but in the very unsubtle ways that many Hindus know. I have what we call a Janmakshar, a premium personalized horoscope. Based on the positions of the stars at the exact time and location of my birth, my Janmakshar provides a map of my life that Indian astrologers can use to predict, for a fee, of course, everything, including my temperament. She will be sharp-tongued and stubborn. And my career. She will have great success and be well-respected in government. Some astrologers are naturally gifted, while others rely on software programs to do their divining. I have read that India may be home to more astrologers than the rest of the world combined, because so many people there seek astrological advice on questions large and small. When is an auspicious time of day for the wedding? Should I take this job? Will I win the case? When my parents came to America, they brought their astrological beliefs with them. Over the years, they would return from their annual trips to India with updated readings in Gujarati or Hindi about my siblings and me from astrologers boasting famous clientele. After rifling through my parents' bags for new clothes and junk from the bazaar, we children would gather around the kitchen table as my mother put on her glasses to translate our fates. She would sometimes pause and skip entire paragraphs. We would try to guess the bad news from which she was shielding us. She claimed that she didn't want the predictions to unduly influence our decisions. Over the years, several of those predictions did seem to come true. My brother did get sick enough at 25 to require a kidney transplant. My sister did marry at 30. And though I had been painfully shy as a teenager, I did grow into a sharp-tongued lawyer, well-respected in government. I'm not sure we thought too much of those predictions when we were living them. If we did, we chalked them up to coincidence. Being Indian, by way of New Jersey, I often railed against this determinism. I pointed to the variations among the readings as evidence of their falsity, even if a few did come true. The lawyer in me prized rationality and logic. The idea that outcomes were predetermined ran contrary to all my work, education, and ambition. I found my parents' belief in fate unnerving and un-American. My father would say, "Ummi, it's not that your fate changes with each reading. That is fixed. It's just that some astrologers are better at telling your story than others." One of the many stories that my parents, and eventually I too, wanted to change with each telling was that of my marriage. When I was 27, my fiancé broke off our engagement after 2 years of us trying to buoy our relationship. It sank not so much from a lack of love, but from a comedy of errors involving suspicions of black magic by members of our feuding families that led to distrust between my fiancé and me, ultimately unraveling our plans and dreams. As I lay catatonic on my parents' couch in the aftermath, my mother, heartbroken, tried to comfort me. As she stroked my hair, she told me there always had been a prediction that I would have a broken relationship at this age. She had wanted to tell me earlier when things weren't going well that it may be better to break it off. But that was one of the many times she had hoped the astrologers were wrong. She reassured me that none of this was anyone's fault. Not mine, my fiancé's, his family's or ours. It was simply our fate, which had been written long before he and I met. I couldn't make sense of the fact that despite how much we loved each other and how well we got along, we hadn't ended up together. I had grown tired of replaying every wrong move and angry word. I couldn't silence my inner voice, which kept nagging, if only, and maybe if you hadn't. Instead, I tried to relax into the great comfort that none of our behavior had mattered. I told myself I had been trapped in a choose-your-own-adventure book in which all the paths led to the same sad ending. And in this way, I finally managed to peel myself from the couch and return to my life in New York, where I had to study for the bar exam. A few weeks later, I was back in New Jersey for lunch with my parents, where they presented me with an envelope and a small plastic bag containing a pendant with a translucent blue-tinged tear-shaped stone. "It's a moonstone," my father said. "It's expensive and rare," my mother chimed in. I glanced at the envelope. In red typeface, on the upper left corner, were the words Matri Vision, specializing in matrimonial counseling and rituals. It was addressed, with my name misspelled, to Ms. Amita Patel, USA. My heart sank as I remembered ads from some other matrimonial counseling outfit that had appeared constantly on Indian satellite television. Love life not working out? Health problems? Everything going wrong? You may be under black magic. Contact us, and all your problems will be solved. I had always pitied the desperate fools targeted by those ads. Now it seemed the desperate fool was me. My parents explained that the astrologer had predicted a bright marital future for me once an obstacle was removed. Apparently, the position of two Vedic planets in my chart, Rahu and Ketu, was troubling, and my parents should have done a prayer ritual to rid me of the effects when I was born. Instead, they had let these two mischief-making planets have their way with me. The absurdity of the whole thing made me laugh. But I was eager to read the instructions and glad they were in English so my parents would not be able to skip the bad parts. I was to light incense and meditate on Lord Chandra, the god of the moon. I was to wash my moonstone in milk and the waters of the Ganges. Luckily, my parents always have some in the refrigerator. And I was to do this while repeating the Chandra mantra 108 times. I was to wear the moonstone for 90 days while trying to be active, cool, and health conscious. Meanwhile, back in India, Matri Vision's Brahmins would do a separate moonstone prayer ritual for me, and I would need to fast until 4 p.m. on the day they performed it, which would take place in 60 days. What did I have to lose? I wore my moonstone religiously and hoped Rahu and Ketu would stop messing with me. After taking the bar exam, I headed off on a 7-week adventure to Southeast Asia. I was in Laos on the 60th day of the moonstone prayer ritual which I had completely forgotten about. But as fate would have it, I had given morning alms to the monks in Luang Prabang. The ritual made me want to fast, just as I sometimes did at home when my mother asked me to do so for religious reasons. So I had. After 90 days, my life had improved drastically. I no longer awoke feeling frustrated and angry. My Hindi movie melodrama had stopped replaying itself in my dreams. I still wasn't sure I would love again, but it didn't matter as much. I now believed there was nothing more I could have done to save that relationship. My father called and said that he had spoken with the counselor from Matri Vision and that a final step remained. I could complete it the next time I visited. When I went to New Jersey that weekend, my parents handed me a basket shrouded in black cloth. In order to move on from my broken engagement, I would need to place the basket in the branches of a leafless tree and not look back. On my way out to the yard, I peeked inside the basket and saw two bangles, a cheap necklace, earrings, a tin of coal, and a handkerchief. I reached up, placed it securely between two branches, and walked away. I was tempted to look back, but had come far enough that I was not going to spoil it in the home stretch. Soon after, just as predicted by Matri Vision, I met my next marital opportunity. An Orthodox Jewish man 3 years younger, as improbable a match for me as my fiancé had been probable. But now I was more open to improbable because, you know, fate. And as I slid into love with him against all of my better judgment, I felt liberated, not constrained, by the fact that our story, too, had already been written. But I kept wearing my moonstone, just in case.
This podcast is supported by Cartier.
For my 20th wedding anniversary, my husband gave me an amazing letter. We were having lunch in the park, the same park we got married in. And in the letter, he talks about all of the journeys and things that we've done. And he says, if I said to you, you were going to watch African sunrises from Ghana, if I said to you, you'll eat breakfast in Paris and sleep in the desert, dance in the streets of New Orleans or ride a camel, all while by my side, at the time it would have seemed like a wild dream. But yet those dreams are in fact our memories. I cried like a baby when I read that letter. And I cry every time I read it. It made me feel in love. It made me feel in love.
With love, from Cartier.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Hey, Misha.
Hi, Mia. How's it going?
Pretty well, thank you. So I have many questions for you.
Okay, cool.
You wrote this essay in 2008. What has happened in your life since then?
Wow, so much has happened. I know probably top of the list, I broke up with a Jewish guy. And so I really took stock of my life at that time after I'd written the essay. And you know, the economy was crashing. My nephew had been diagnosed with leukemia. And I was working at a law firm, which, you know, I did really enjoy the work that I was doing there. but it wasn't the life I wanted to be living.
Yeah.
And I decided to take a leap and left the law firm with no real plan and took a duffel bag and set out on a real adventure. Mm. I thought I would always be successful, or at least according to the horoscope, I would be. And so I decided to take some chances.
So knowing your fate actually kind of acted like an insurance policy, and it allowed you to take more risks, like quitting your job.
Yeah. The essay actually made me explore the idea of destiny and horoscopes and the karma doctrine in Hinduism. Hmm. And I came upon these Indian folktales about how people outwitted their fate. And one that really stuck with me was about the children of a king. When they were born, he had their horoscopes done, and their fates were pretty wretched. The son was going to be a farmer who only owned one ox. And the king said, "How could this be?" And he sent off, you know, his Brahmin to think about that. And in the meanwhile, the fate actually came true. The Brahmin came back, found the son, and he said, "Today, sell your ox." And the son said, "What do you mean? I've only got one ox. Mm-hmm. I can't sell it." And he said, "No, yeah. Sell it." And he did.
Uh-huh.
He sold the ox, and the next morning, another ox appeared. Hmm. The Brahmin explained to him, "Your fate is to have one ox. So you will always have one ox." I sort of looked at that and said, you know, maybe my fate isn't to get married.
Uh-huh.
And in taking all of those chances, I did feel extremely rewarded. Mm-hmm. You know, I might have only had my one ox, but I was living each day, and still do kind of embrace that way of looking at things.
So it seems like, if I have it right, when you were young, you were kind of dubious of your parents' beliefs, but now you've come to accept them more?
Yeah.
Yeah. You wrote in your piece that your parents' beliefs struck you when you were young as un-American. How have your thoughts about your Americanness changed?
Yeah, I think the very American part of me seeks answers and expects that if you do enough research, you can answer everything you'd like to answer. And the Indian side of me, or, you know, especially with my parents, there's certain things that are unexplainable. Hmm. You know, when I was growing up, I remember going to the village where my dad grew up, and simple things like, you know, where, oh, there was always an accident in this one spot on the road, must be a ghost.
Wow.
And it's like, well, maybe the tree is actually blocking the vision of the drivers, and that, you know, or maybe there's a pothole on that section of the road. But there was just no question about this. Like, oh, maybe it's a ghost. And that was that. And there was no further investigation of it. And I did find that very unnerving, the acceptance of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And now I think as I've gotten older, I'm actually really glad to have that Indian side of me, and to have been brought up in a home and a culture that understands the limits of human knowledge and understanding. Mm. Mm-hmm. And lacks the hubris of that American way of thinking of, not only can I understand, I will understand, and let me explain it to you.
Mm. So I feel like I have to ask, what is your love life like now? And if you were or are really serious about someone, would you have your horoscope or your birth chart compared with theirs?
I think I'm going to plead the fifth on what my love life is like now. But no, I will say I definitely have gone forth into the dating world and love generally, understanding that for me, marriage might not actually be even what I want. It's more finding love. And so I'm actively looking for that rather than marriage. And so the question of, would I compare the charts? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I recently asked my dad if he'd compared charts with my mom when they first got married, and or before they got married, because they had an arranged marriage. And he said, oh, no, back then we didn't do any of that. you know? And I said, well, aren't you curious to do it now? And he said, why? I've been married to her for 51 years. We've lived out the destiny.
Yeah.
And he said, whether we were a match or not, we're together.
Mm, beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Amisha. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thanks so much, Mia. It was great talking to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Modern Love is produced by Julia Botero with help from Hans Buto and Tina Antolini. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. The executive producer is Wendy Dorr. Today's episode was mixed by Corey Schreppel.
This week's essay was written by Amisha Patel and read by Sonila Nankani.
Special thanks to Julia Simon, Mahima Choblani, Bonnie Wertheim, Anya Stremian, Sam Dolnick, Vicky Merrick, Lisa Tobin, Corey Sika, and Ryan Wegner at Autumn. I'm Mia Lee.
And I'm Dan Jones.
We're taking off next week, but we'll be back the following week with more stories from Modern Love. Thank you for listening.